ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing Jade Lovell, an award-winning neuroscientist, science marketer, and host of SciQ on the Young Turks Network. Jade has spent a decade helping scientific organizations advocate for their work. She's the founder and CEO of ReAgency, a New York-based PR company that works primarily with science and information-based clients. Jade, thank you so much for joining us today. You have this fascinating background as an award-winning neuroscientist, science marketer, and now founder of the ReAgency Media. Now, can you tell us a little bit about that journey?
Sure. So I trained as a neuroscientist and I love science. I love science so much, but I got really frustrated with the way that science is taught. I kind of grew up thinking that science was the greatest. And then you run into all these people that are like, oh, science, I hate that subject. And I started to realize that it's not that science itself is boring or confusing, but that the way we communicate it sucks. I'm sure you have been in that high school classroom and thought, I'm so bored right now. And so I wanted to change the way that at that point, how we educate people in science. And so I did a master's of science communication to try and learn how we're supposed to communicate science and how to get people to trust in science as well. Because, you know, science is supposed to be about truth and reality. And yet there's a lot of people that don't trust what science has to say, particularly on issues like climate change. So I think the perception of science is super important now more than it has been ever in the past. And so being able to have a strong marketing around, like scientists don't like to think they need marketing. They're like, oh, I do my science and the facts speak for themselves. And if I just tell everyone climate change is happening, then of course they will understand and they will do something about it. But unfortunately, that's not how we humans work. And so we set up ReAgency to try and be that force for good marketing, great communication, and being able to engage the public in a complicated topic like science.
Right. The storytelling of science, then they're bringing, if that's how the public learns and takes on board information, that's what you're doing. Yes,
that's exactly right. We figured out that the best way to engage people is through storytelling. And there's a lot of reasons why, which I'll go into. But storytelling is the way that that hooks everyone. Like when you go out and you spoke to Park Howell about the power of storytelling in one of your earlier podcasts, but you go out into the world and you come home and at night, your husband, wife, significant other, your dog will say, how was your day? And then you'll say, you know, you'll tell them a story about like, I went out into the special world. I fought battles and I overcame demons and monsters, and then I came home to the ordinary world. And that's the basis of a story. So even in something as simple as how is your day, we're saying, tell me a story. And so if scientists can tell stories, they're a lot more engaging, they're a lot more human, and you know, a lot more interesting as well.
Do you think that storytelling, while it may be new to science, do you think that in the broader marketing that storytelling is, that people have lost the thread in storytelling as well? Or is it really just that you're bringing this thinking to science? I mean, is it part of both? Is it different? I mean, I guess, how was marketing done before in science? Is there a total absence of marketing? Or
yeah, good technical question. So way back in the 1980s, 1981, there was a thing released called the Bodmer Report in the UK, which is basically a report on how science is going in the public, how many people kind of understood basic scientific principles. And so what they found was that a lot of people just didn't understand things that you would kind of expect them to understand, like how the moon rotates around the earth and, you know, basic scientific principles. And so they said, well, look, we just need to like give people information. We need to force more science education on people. And so scientists just kind of think that's how it works. You have an empty brain and I will fill your brain with the information and then you'll have the information and off you go. But that's not how marketers work. Marketers assume that your brain is already full. You already have beliefs, desires, you've had a history, and that they just need to figure out what sort of things make you tick as an individual. And if they can just figure that out and capture it, then they'll be able to market to you. So it's a completely different way of approaching communication.
Huh, that's really interesting. You're so right. I've never really actually thought of it that way.
Yeah.
I'm interested also, it's not only that the creators of these science stories are uncomfortable with marketing, but also that these stories themselves aren't simple stories. They're complex. How much of the complexity is part of the challenge?
It comes back to a guy called Randy Olson, who developed what's called the ABT, or the and but therefore template. So all stories, no matter how complex and no matter how simple, can be told in the and but therefore. And so for most of us, that is, once you figure out the template, it's easy to tell a story in that way, or your story kind of fits the structure. But for science, they are inherently drawn to complexity, and they don't ever quite get to the point of the story because they're such expert, subject experts. They can occasionally make their stories so complicated that the average human can't follow all of the caveats. So rather than telling a nice structured story in the way that we know people's brains work, they add too many caveats to it and lose people along the way. And I'm sure, we've all had that experience of being in a science lecture or being in a class and being lost because there's too many caveats or too much complexity in the topic that we didn't quite understand how it all fit together.
Right. Well, I would say it actually distilling that essential essence and message would also apply to other things. I mean, one of the challenges for media brands launching new programs is you're bringing them a product, which in one sense they know what it is, it's a program, but beyond that, they don't know what it is. So unlike a consumer product where they understand this is soap and there are certain assumptions brought to it, it's a story, and the stories can be complex and confusing. And a lot of times people fixate on trying to get all the nuances when in fact maybe they just need, at least for the launch campaign, when it's a brand new property, to keep it this narrow message that will then hook into a viewer more successfully. You've won several awards for digital campaigns. How did you approach those campaigns?
That's a good question. You always, when you're starting a campaign, you want to have a point of difference and a way of cutting through. And I think a good campaign is something that can raise people's interests, which is easy to do, but then also sustain people's interests. Mm. And so for all of the campaigns that I've ever been involved with, one in particular was we won for Unilever and the client Magnum, my favorite type of ice cream, not the condom. We won an award for best digital marketing. And that was at a time when digital marketing was really exploding onto the scene and there was a lot of creativity happening. But I think a good digital campaign ties together all of the latest technology, all the things that you cover on your podcast, all of the latest stuff that's out there. So it could be wearables, it could be having a great content hub, having great outreach strategy, but having a story that runs through all of it that is consistent. And so being able to tell a good story on one platform is difficult. Being able to tell a good story that engages people across multiple platforms is award-winning. And so I think whenever we've had the most success, it's because we've figured out what a good narrative is and then been able to tell it consistently across multiple platforms and been able to reach as wide a possible audience.
Unilever is pretty good about working cross-platforms. Are they an ongoing client, or was this a one-off with them?
Yeah, this was under the agency Golin, who are, along with Weber Shandwick, one of the largest PR agencies out there, and Unilever is a long-term client of theirs, so they're really good at, they've got good people on their team. Being Unilever, they're a huge organization, and so they are really, they're willing to try different things, which is a dream. I mean, anyone that's out there that's a marketer knows that sometimes people are scared. Being with a client like Unilever that has the resources and the will to make things happen is a dream come true. And so for this is called the Black and Pink campaign, to celebrate a birthday of Magnum, and they launched two new flavors, and they wanted to tell that story across as many different platforms as they could and explore these new things like content marketing that was just coming onto the scene. Mm. So how can they use video? How can they use social? How can they use web? How can they use fixed placements outside on the public? How could they also tie in a pop-up store? How can they have a great, unique customer experience? How can they take people who are out there at their pop-up store and get them to push the content onto social media? Like, what can they do to make people talk about their product? And they're willing to try new things, which was super fun to work on.
Yeah, well, and I'm curious though, because ice cream isn't really in the science bailiwick, if you will. So
that's right.
How did they find you? And was it because of some of your work with science, or what? How did that happen?
So my career has had a few twists and turns. I started out as a neuroscientist, and then because I had this passion for communications, I did my master's degree in science communication, and then I went and worked at CMG Group, who are the holding company for, they're part of Interpublic Groups. They had Weber Shandwick, they had Golan Harris, they had Jack Morton, the events agency, that future brand. And so I got to work, this was right when digital was really hitting the scene in like 2013, when everyone, I think the company realized, wow, we're spending a lot of money on digital creation. So we're paying video crews. We should have this stuff in-house. So my job was to run all of the digital strategy across Asia Pacific and to launch these digital studios. So I was taking my communications background and not so much my science background at that stage and applying it to this newfangled field called content marketing. And that was also about the same time that this new trend called storytelling came out, and everyone overnight in about 2014 decided that they were a storyteller. Fun fact, storyteller is used in, I think it's now 50,000 Twitter profiles. So when people are describing themselves, storyteller, I think, is the most commonly used descriptor. Mm. So I don't really think there's 50,000 people out there that are true storytellers. I think what people mean when they say that is, I am an interesting communicator, or, you know, I'm not boring. But what they don't often, I don't think any of those people could really tell you like what the structure of a story is and what's the difference between a story and a piece of curious information. Most people couldn't tell you that. So they need to listen to your podcast, Gabriella.
And that's right. They do. I've never really, you know, these words become so popular, and then they lose their meaning because the brand dilution, if you will.
So like when storytelling became the cool new thing, I think it takes some of the power away from people that really do get storytelling and have invested in figuring out what it is. But the worst thing you can do is say, call yourself a storyteller when you don't know what a story is. So for anyone that wants to know, you've got to figure out what the structure of a story is that defines it as a story and not just a list of information.
You've got your work cut out for you telling people that, I have to say, with all the listicles that are, you know, populating everywhere.
And that's not to say that listicles aren't interesting. Listicles are great. There's nothing wrong with a listicle.
No, but it's throwaway. It doesn't stay with you, does it? I mean, I think part of the thing that a story structure does is it has an organizing principle, which then stays with you and you carry with you and you make your own and you incorporate it. And then it allows you to become brand amplifier.
That's right. And putting my science hat on for a second, to put a science bent on what you just said, Yuri Hassan is a neuroscientist and a researcher when it comes to storytelling. And he did this wonderful experiment where he showed people two different things. They were either looking at a video of just a scene in a park with nothing in particular going on, you know, people walking past, people walking their dogs, bus going in the background. And then he showed another group a scene from a Hitchcock movie, right at that climax scene where the guy's got the gun and he, you know, is he going to shoot her or not? And he found that with the people that were watching the scene in the park, that they had very low consistency between them of what they were thinking. So some people were looking at the dog, some people were looking at the tree, some people were looking at the bus, they're all thinking different things. And that their brains weren't very active. Whereas if they're watching the story, the different sections of the brain lit up, and they also lit up in the same places. So there was very high degree of consistency between the different scans. So storytelling, like, it's not just when we say this word engagement, it seems really philosophical or it's hard to quantify, but you can quantify it at a neuroscientific level, that storytelling does lead to engagement at the neuroscientific level, and people's brains do turn on when you tell a good story, and that's why they become so memorable.
How would marketers from other industries, like, what would you say are the best practices, the portable things from what you're doing in the science space, and how could they bring it on board to what they're doing?
Good question. So I'll tell you one study that we started off at Weber Shandwick, and some data that I think is really fundamental to anyone that's in the communication space. So our new thing is called the evolution of social media by narrative pressure. You all know about evolution, that things change over time, animals change over time, and the way they change depends on what in their environment is pressuring them. What we found with social media and digital media is that the same thing is true. So if you're thinking about writing a Facebook post, the common sense approach is always like, oh, make it really short and snappy because people have a short attention span. And so when I was at Weber-Shandwick, we did a piece of research to figure out if that assumption was actually true. Is the best content the stuff that's short and snappy? And what we found was the exact opposite, that it wasn't the short pieces of content between 0 and 50 words. It was the longer pieces of content, 200 words, 250 words or longer. What we realized is not that the word length itself mattered, but that in 250 words, you're able to tell a story. 140 characters, you can't. We found that, you know, it's narrative, so story, that is the key pressure on social media. So that affects not just the content that's put out there, but also the platforms. So companies like Twitter are good at one thing, which is kind of sharing links. So they're having this narrative pressure put on them to be able to turn Twitter into a storytelling tool. They know that content works when it can tell a story, but if you can't tell a story on Twitter, their whole platform is broken. Mm-hmm. And we worked this out. This was a theory we had. And then surprise, surprise, a couple of months ago, Twitter expanded the way that the character limit works so that you could fit more information into a tweet. So getting it closer to storytelling. And that's the evolution of social media, is that it's evolving towards being able to tell a story. We see it on Facebook, that it was the content, you know, it's really easy to quantify content and say text works better or photos work better or video works better. Common sense version would be that video works better than text. But it wasn't so much that it's video that works better than text, but that if you could tell a story in whatever style of content you posted, that piece would do a lot better than any other style. So if we're looking at things in the wrong way when we measure content on Facebook to try and figure out what works best. What works best is stories. And it doesn't matter if that story is told in text, in a photo, or in a video. If it's a story and it's well structured, then it's going to do well. Whereas if it's a beautiful video, but it doesn't have a story in it, it's only going to get to a certain point. And so we're seeing this evolutionary pressure put on the content that's posted. So the content that goes viral, that survives, usually has some sort of story attached to it. And the types of platforms that do well are platforms that can tell a story. And you've seen when Instagram first came out, it was just photos. And as it's evolved so that people can tell better stories. The same is true of Snapchat. Like, they even call it Snapchat stories. So when right. you group Snapchats together to be able to tell a story with them is a Snapchat story. So a lot of the platforms that are out there, the ones that are doing well and the direction that even the platforms that are doing well, the direction they're heading in is to be a narrative storytelling tool.
Well, but then why did Vine fail?
That's a good question. I think there's a number of different factors, but definitely 6 seconds it's a challenge to tell a story. People were able to kind of talk fast and fit it into 6 seconds and do things that what we would call curious. So they're interesting, they're curious. It's like a cool stunt and you go, oh, wow, that's cool. And it's great from a moment in time, like it's great for shock but it still doesn't turn on that part of the brain that responds well to a story. So for example, if you see a guy like doing a really amazing like bike trick or like doing a great ski jump or doing a great ski jump and then falling on his face, that's funny, but it wasn't the same resonance that a story would be. So if you had a little bit longer than 6 seconds, you could tell a full story. So you'd get to know like, okay, this guy, he's attempting to do a jump, but then he's fallen on his face. Therefore, everyone's laughing at him. You can fit that whole narrative in a lot more easily. And people were able to do it in 6 seconds. It wasn't impossible, but it was tough. And that's why you saw Instagram extend the length, or first of all, introduce video and then expand so that you can get a full 60-second video in. 60 seconds is a lot. It's a lot easier format to tell a story in.
Right. Are stories really, do they really do better than the grumpy cat?
They really do. They really do. So all the data, and I'm presenting at South by Southwest in March on this exact topic. What we found is that the one thing, no matter how you slice it, the one thing that we tell that works best is when content can tell a story. And so if you measure by narrative ability, and this is true also in the election. So looking back to the 2016 election, we measured, we and Randy Olson, who runs a amazing training program called Story Circles, which I encourage everyone to look up. We had a look at the narrative index of the speeches of the candidate and found that the speeches where there was a high and to but ratio, so if there's an and, there's also a but nearby, those speeches were doing a lot better or had a higher narrative index than the ones that are just and. So unfortunately, Hillary Clinton was very good at and. So she'd often have, you know, she'd write policies where she had had 20 points as to her 20 point approach on how she was going to solve this problem. And, you know, as a scientist and as a rational human being, I loved a detailed policy, but it didn't engage people in the same way that Donald Trump did with his very, he would explain like, America was once a great country, but now it's not so great. Therefore, we're going to make America great again. And so even in his campaign slogan, he had a story implicit in there, whereas Hillary wasn't as adept at telling those narratives. And when we measured the speeches, we found that Hillary had a narrative index of around 10, so very low, whereas Donald Trump was above 30. So he was right up there with the best speech makers and storytellers of our time, which potentially explains a little bit of the difference between the results.
I think it's absolutely true. I mean, that was one of the things internally people I was talking to were talking about, the failure to create a compelling story and narrative, that she didn't manage that as well as he did.
And it wasn't just her. I mean, Barack Obama, at the end of his first term, he was asked, do you have any regrets? And the regret that he named was that he didn't do a good enough job of telling America's story. So he felt it when he didn't make a point of telling stories and being able to articulate the vision and where he wanted to go, he suffered. And so you saw in the second term a lot more investment in his narrative index rose over time, depending on which speech it was, obviously, but he got better at prioritizing telling stories and putting things in context. So the basic structure of this is where we are, but this is the challenge that we're facing. Therefore, this is what we're going to do about it.
Right. Well, it's interesting, the issue of complexity. A lot of the issues facing politicians are complex. And so I think you have another potential client base right there around political issues and distilling them into compelling arguments. It's stories, or at least even just rearranging them, because they're complex and it isn't so easy always to chunk them up. But if they could be chunked up, if we could deliver things that need to be listened to in more bite-sized pieces, maybe they'll get taken on board.
And it's all about arouse and fulfill. So you've got to arouse interest. And the best way to arouse interest is to tell a story. And once people are aroused and they're paying attention, but if you just start with the detail, and Hillary was classic, because I think she had good policies, but you know, she didn't make enough of an effort to articulate what the problems were. And to articulate one problem, she would group a lot of things together. You could basically feel the background of her speeches. You could feel the like 20 people in the room all trying to get their soundbite into her speech. And so her speeches often didn't have a narrative thread running through them, but instead they were really, really great soundbites all chunked together in this one long speech that didn't have a direction going through it. So they're all the policy points were great, but if she'd taken away the complexity and put a narrative thread through the whole thing, she would have had, a different result.
Well, it's interesting. You had written another piece called Innovation the Lazy Way. I want to understand, what do you mean?
I talk about innovation a lot. We are all lazy. Our brains are lazy and we naturally go to laziness. So that's why I love the ABT template when we're telling stories, because I'm a lazy person and I'll often prepare things at the last minute. I have a show on PsyQ on the Young Turks Network. And, you know, if we're trying to make content and you've got a report on something that happened that day, you've got 5 minutes to get ready to say it. You have to have a template that helps you. And so I rely on the ABT all the time. There's one interesting thing about innovation that I think will appeal to anyone that ever has worked in a field where they're siloed. Innovation is rarely something completely new. It's usually taking a thing and applying it in a new context. So for example, my agency, Reagency, we're taking marketing and we're applying it to the science field where it hasn't existed, but where marketing is, it hasn't really had a history there. And so innovation happens when you are sitting at an intersection of two things, like Apple is at the intersection of design and technology. So if we're working in silos, if you're in an organization that works in silos, you rarely innovate. You might make progress at the edges, but true innovation happens when you're working cross-disciplinarily. I was talking to someone about what would happen if you had $1 billion, how would you increase innovation? And I think the answer is buy coffee and donuts for everyone. Because if you put coffee and donuts in the lobby of a building, you get a huge increase in the amount of cross-disciplinary conversations that are happening between people who wouldn't normally talk to each other. The budget to buy coffee and donuts, no one ever wants to be the person that fronts up the budget for coffee and donuts, but organizations that put in the effort to get people to talk to each other find a lot higher levels of innovation. innovation, or at least that people are talking about problems they're facing and having different perspectives shone on that problem. So you have all these really expensive innovation programs, but coffee and donuts is the lazy and cheap way of doing it.
What about, I mean, it's interesting though, because there it actually speaks to telecommuting, working from home, work-life balance, people not being in the office anymore. Is that anti-innovation?
Well, you can end up being more isolated when you're working from home, but I think that we've got the tools to do it. And I know that there's a huge debate ongoing, particularly with when Yahoo announced that they wouldn't allow their staff to work from home anymore. People are torn between, you know, what makes a good workplace. But I think that encouraging conversations, whether they're between people at work from home or in the real world, doesn't matter how you do it, but knowing that that's a priority. Rarely do you see companies that want to innovate spending time getting people to talk to each other. A lot of companies will really put pressure on their employees to work really hard and stay back late, but rarely will they say, no, like spend an hour just chatting to your colleagues and not working and socialize instead.
Right. It's almost like the way we schedule children very intensively. And so there's less creativity because they're just simply scheduled. You actually need a little downtime where it isn't programmed, where you have some space to think, talk, and then have those aha moments because you've onboarded information that isn't part of your regular stuff, I guess.
That's right. And like, I know in that particular article I was talking about, Alexander Fleming, he invented penicillin. He didn't invent penicillin. He discovered penicillin. But he was like the exact opposite of what most organizations want. Most people want like a clean lab. They like the automaton worker that like gets in, is really structured, goes to all their meetings and like does the work really efficiently. This guy discovered penicillin because he left all of his petri dishes out, didn't clean up after himself, got back after some weeks and the petri dishes in his lab, he noticed that there was one of them was contaminated and there was a circle of bacteria that had died. And he was like, wow, I wonder what it is that's causing that. That's weird.
What in my filth has done this?
Yeah, exactly. And so like, you know, so many points along the way, this could have not been discovered. He could have been really neat and thrown his petri dishes away. He could have been the type of guy that didn't go away on holiday because he was so studious. He could have had come back and thought, oh my God, I've got a meeting now. I have to just throw this stuff away, and not had the time to be curious and investigate what was going on. And most scientific discoveries aren't eureka moments where we go, oh my God, I've got the answer. They're, wow, that's funny moments. And then having the time and the creative space to actually investigate. Right. So that's what innovation is.
Right. Well, that's fantastic. We have run through our time. So I do have like one thing I always do, and it's really quick. So if you don't mind, we can do that. It's sort of one of those word games where I say a word and you say whatever word pops into your head next. No thinking about it. Are you ready?
Yep.
Facebook.
Fun.
Google.
Information.
Snapchat.
Too far advanced for me.
Twitter.
Boring.
YouTube.
My living.
Sorry. Ad blockers.
The devil.
Art.
Creativity.
Virtual reality.
Future.
Augmented reality.
Also future.
Artificial intelligence.
Scary.
Thank you so much for spending so much time with us. I really appreciate it. It's been excellent fun talking to you.
Really, really fun. And I love this podcast because in a digital world, knowing what's up next is the only way to survive. So thank you for putting in the effort to put all the new things together in one place for everyone to enjoy.
Well, thank you. We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who've helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media, and a big thank you to our guest, Jade Lovell. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week right here on Up Next.